Keeping an Eye on Harvey, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Hurricane Harvey is churning toward the Texas coast, gathering strength as it goes, and scientists are going high-tech to determine the role climate change might play in creating such powerful storms.
The way we see hurricanes today, a vast array of satellites, aircraft, reconnaissance missions, is very different from the way we saw hurricanes 100 years ago.
Plus, a transgender midshipman faces a tough choice.
I have to commit to another 2 years at the Naval Academy and another 5 years of active duty service, but I know I'm trans, and which one is more important to me?
Those stories, plus two incredibly loyal Canadian sheepdogs, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. When does a tweet from a nation's leader set policy? It's not just an issue here with President Trump. In Canada, too. That's where we start today. Remember in January when President Trump signed an executive order banning travelers from 7 Muslim-majority countries? Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded with a tweet. It welcomed those fleeing persecution and violence, regardless of their faith. And it ended with the hashtag Welcome to Canada. Since then, there's been a surge of asylum seekers crossing into Canada from the U.S. Authorities north of the border are struggling to cope, and Trudeau is being blamed for encouraging that surge. Here's Conservative politician Michelle Rempel.
That hashtag Welcome to Canada tweet has never been clarified by the Prime Minister. I think he's giving false hope to people crossing the border.
Most of those crossing into Canada from the U.S. have been arriving in Quebec. As many as 250 a day, according to officials there. Since July, the vast majority are from Haiti, as Emma Jacobs reports.
A yellow school bus pulls up and idles outside a YMCA shelter in Montreal. Bags come off first, including a child's pink suitcase, then the passengers of all ages. One heavily pregnant woman has a toddler over her shoulder. People call to each other in Haitian Creole. These newcomers are among thousands who have been arriving from the U.S. Michael Jean-Pierre has been here for more than a week. He came all the way from Florida. The United States is a beautiful country, Jean-Pierre says. The reason I left is because the government wanted to deport immigrants. I was very, very afraid of the deportations there. That's why I came here. More than 6,000 people have been intercepted crossing into Quebec since January. Around 90% are Haitians, many of whom decided to leave the U.S. after the Trump administration indicated it might let a temporary protected status put in place after the 2010 earthquake expire in January. This means people in the U.S. under that program could be deported back to Haiti. Jean-Pierre heard on social media that Haitians would be welcomed in Canada.
Oui, sur Facebook.
Yes, on Facebook, Jean-Pierre says. I saw a lot of messages from people explaining how the government of Canada will receive Haitians here with a lot of love, a lot of wisdom. That's why I came here to seek refugee status. But since most migrants like Jean-Pierre would be turned away at official border crossings, they've been walking across elsewhere. Once they're inside the country, they're being detained and processed in a camp on the border, then sent on to shelters in Montreal. Their future here in Canada is uncertain, despite what they may have heard. Canada has had a slightly higher acceptance rate for Haitian asylum seekers than the U.S., but those arriving from the U.S. could have a difficult time proving they face imminent danger in Haiti after years living abroad. And the country's extreme poverty is not grounds to stay. Further complicating things, many of the children are U.S. citizens born in America, so they could end up being separated from their parents. For now, Montreal has set up several shelters for the new wave of refugees, including one with 900 beds in the old Olympic Stadium. Some lucky people will stay with family members in Montreal's own large Haitian-Canadian community. Late in the day, some of these locals arrive outside the stadium with food for the newcomers. Two men haul a trunk full of bread from the bakery where they work. An older woman has bags of Tupperware full of rice and meat. It's the government, not me, who can say yes to them, she says, but she can make this small contribution. There are a small number of people arriving of other nationalities. One man named Precious is a journalist from Nigeria. He says he came to the U.S. last September to escape threats over his reporting. At first, he says he and his family felt safe there.
Yeah, it was actually after the election, especially when Trump came in, you know, it really became something different.
Precious says he had a press visa, but that his wife and daughter had overstayed their visas and were afraid of being deported. So the family joined the stream, walking to Canada to try their luck here.
I would say God bless Canada because, I mean, it's a place where our fears have been relieved for now.
For now is likely to be at least several months as the Canadian government works through the surge of applications for asylum. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Montreal.
Mireille Paquet is a political scientist and assistant professor at Concordia University in Montreal. Mireille, what did you think of that piece? Does that ring true to you?
Absolutely. I think the piece was excellent in showing both the motivations of people crossing the border right now into Montreal, as well as the complexity of the system they're facing.
Now, some Canadians are pointing a finger at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and saying kind of he's caused this overrun of migrants after he tweeted out an invitation. This was after Donald Trump was elected, and his tweet read, "To those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canadians will welcome you, regardless of your faith." And it had the hashtag, Welcome to Canada. What kind of impact has that messaging had on the number of asylum seekers heading to Canada?
It's a really good question, and it's also really hard to answer because while this tweet has been sent out by the Prime Minister, we're in no position to know whether this is what is motivating people to come or whether it is a situation in the U.S. or elsewhere, but right now we're focusing on U.S. border crossing, whether the political situation as well as declaration in the U.S. that are mostly motivating migrants. Social media have played a major role in decision-making for the current border crossing for several people. But at the same time, whether this is a retweet or a retranslation of the declaration by the Prime Minister, or if other people are just spreading information, we can't be sure that this is the only force at play.
But practically speaking, is Canada able to process this influx of people?
Right now, the situation is a little complex because the amount has been pretty big. And so the resources are starting to be dire, but we're still able, it seems, to process those people, at least to make sure that we can provide them with some safety and we can get them involved with the government in finding out what will be the status, making sure that status determination goes according to the rules and procedures in Canada.
Has Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had to tone down his welcoming image and, hey, come on, we're all great? Has he had to kind of walk that back a bit because of criticism?
So what we're seeing right now is a lot of messaging related to the fact that there is a system, that there is due process, that the rule of law apply in Canada. So there's not going to be queue jumping. People that are going to come in Canada will not be automatically accepted. They will be processed according to our system. And that's really kind of the line that the Prime Minister is using, especially since yesterday where he made a large press conference with a specific team that was created with the Premier of Quebec and a lot of other stakeholder in the management of the issue.
What isn't queue jumping happening simply by the fact that people are wandering across, you know, fields and unguarded borders to get into Canada? And then they're being, you know, processed. Isn't that queue jumping just the start of all this?
This is an important question, and I'm not sure I have an answer, but the way I would always answer my students to this question is that the system is not fair, right? The international system that determines who has the right to go into a country, who has the right to claim status, is not a fair system. So from that standpoint, a question of queue jumping is kind of moot as far as I'm concerned.
Is your sense, are people getting annoyed with the number of people coming over? Are people losing their patience, or are Canadians saying, you know, come on in?
I think there is fear and there is an issue of understanding what's happening. And I think right now it's really a lot about confusion and about understanding this new position Canada is in, which was not something that we had to think about before the election of Donald Trump. So we were a place where now people might want to cross our borders by foot to claim status. It's just used to be so seldomly the case before.
Mireille Paquet is a political scientist and assistant professor at Concordia University in Montreal. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Some of the strongest pushback against the new arrivals in Canada has come from a far-right group in Quebec called La Mue, the Wolf Pack. They've held rallies to protest the government's refugee policy and were involved in a violent clash with counter-protesters in Quebec City last weekend. Jonathan Monpetit is a reporter with the CBC in Canada who's been covering La Mue. Jonathan, this group began online, didn't it?
That's right. It began online in 2015, shortly after the newly elected Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made a promise to bring in tens of thousands of Syrian refugees. They initially started as a small online group concerned about radical Islam. But in the past few weeks, as we've seen this kind of sudden surge in asylum seekers from the U.S., they're now talking more explicitly about what they call illegal immigration.
Who are these people who are members of La Mue?
Well, the group was founded by a group of former Canadian soldiers. Many of them had served in Afghanistan. But now the group consists of about 45,000 Facebook members. The active membership is probably much lower, between 5 and 10,000.
Now, are they public and open about who they are, or do they kind of operate behind masks and cloak and dagger?
So they have what they call a secret Facebook page, which you need to be invited into. I have access to that page, and I've been monitoring a lot of their conversations there. And you do see a lot of Islamophobic, sometimes outright racist comments from members. Then a lot of their discourse publicly, they tend to tone down the more outright Islamophobic and controversial elements of their program. But they do have this kind of other side, which is more alarmist, which is more Islamophobic, and which does begin to resemble a lot of the far-right characteristics you see in groups like the Front National in France.
Now, there are conservative parties in Quebec that oppose immigration and want to preserve Quebec's culture. What's their response to La Mue?
They widely condemn La Mue. They take their distance from them. But at the same time, I think, and this is one of the complicated things about Quebec politics at the moment, Quebec culture is front and center for every political party in the province. So while officially they take their distances, you do see some overlap in the concerns expressed by La Mue and mainstream political parties in Quebec.
Do you see many parallels between the alt-right in the U.S. and La Mue?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about La Mue and the far right in general in Quebec is that actually they're not that influenced by the American alt-right. They take their models and their examples from the far right in Europe. So I think La Mue is really sees the Front National as a model for them. There's another extreme far-right group in Quebec called Atalante. They take as their model French identitarian and Italian identitarian group. These are the models that really are circulated in Quebec for obviously linguistic reasons. When I spoke with members of La Mue and asked them what they thought about the alt-right, it really didn't kind of register for them very much.
Now, is there some pushback that, gee, we're just giving this group a lot of attention and so we're kind of exaggerating its importance, or is there real genuine concern that this is something to take seriously?
I think that's the big question, certainly for us journalists and for politicians. We're talking, again, active membership between 5 and 10,000. Now, is that a significant number? In some degree, yes. But so far, they haven't really been able to demonstrate significant influence on political parties, political decision-making. I think that a lot of the concern in Quebec does stem from things that are happening south of the border. I think we Canadians just in general tend to look at what's happening in the U.S. as kind of a cue for understanding what could happen here. So I think some of that alarmism on the part of liberal politicians here is imported from the U.S. It does need to be said, though, that incidents of hate crime against Muslims in Quebec have risen. We did have a shooting at a mosque in January where 6 Muslims were killed. So while I think it's important to put the threat in context, it can't be swept under the rug entirely.
CBC reporter Jonathan Monpetit in Montreal. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks so much, Carol.
The decade-long battle over a Mexican-American studies program in Arizona. That's just ahead on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. This week, a federal judge ruled that a state law in Arizona violated the rights of Mexican-American students there. The law targeted a Mexican-American studies program created for the public schools in Tucson. Behind the ruling is a long legal battle over that program. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke recently with the teacher who created it.
I met Curtis Acosta the week he was testifying in the case. He was under a gag order, and he was nervous.
This has been a hard journey to get to this point. And that's another stress, another pressure. It was like, don't mess it up now.
Acosta's been through two court cases. The first, brought by him and other teachers, failed. Now he was going through a second case, brought by students. It all started 10 years ago, when Acosta created a Mexican-American studies program for Tucson Public Schools to meet a desegregation consent decree. Every day, Acosta had his students recite, "Tú eres mi otro yo," you are my other self, a poem about mutual respect. He had them read stories that are often missing from mainstream classes about gay people, feminists, and people displaced by conquerors. In class, Acosta liked to rap his lessons and use examples from pop culture. All of it was aimed at getting kids to see themselves in history and respect themselves as scholars.
You know, it was a struggle, you know, like trying to convince students that they have this ability to be scholarly when they've been told their whole lives that they're not.
I met one of those kids, Luis Valdez. Before he took Mexican-American studies, he says, he was just a kid from a trailer park who wasn't going anywhere. Nothing he had learned at school taught him about his own family or himself. Mexican-American studies felt like an awakening.
My mind was completely blown. It sort of felt kind of like we were sort of like breaking into this thing that we weren't supposed to be in and kind of like positioning ourselves within it.
Valdez started reading for the first time, beginning with a book called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
It was the first sort of piece of literature that I actually like remember taking pen and highlighter to and like highlighting things and like making notes and reading it during other classes.
So things were good, until one day in 2006, when labor organizer Dolores Huerta gave a speech at Tucson High School and said, quote, "Republicans hate Latinos." Tom Horn was incensed. He was the state superintendent of schools at the time. He called Huerta's words hate speech. Horn brought in another speaker who said, "Republicans don't hate Latinos," and he made all the students attend. They turned their backs and raised their fists. Luis Valdez was there.
There's a picture of me, and there's Horn that's standing right there, and then I'm like, raised fist.
Horn said the Mexican ethnic studies classes had taught students to be disrespectful. He called for the program's elimination. This is him on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360.
This is an absolute abuse of taxpayer money. They sent up a bunch of students to testify at the legislature, and a girl was testifying. A state senator said, "Couldn't you learn these things in other courses?" And she said, "No, before I took this course, I didn't realize I was oppressed. Now that I took the course, I realize that I'm oppressed." We should be teaching the kids that this is a land of opportunity and not teach them the downer, that they're oppressed and they can't get anywhere. They should be angry against their government.
Apparently, the state legislature had the same concerns. It passed a law that cut funding for school districts with classes that advocated ethnic solidarity or promoted resentment toward a class or a race or the government. That was when Acosta and his colleagues sued the state. An associate professor from the University of Arizona was called in to analyze the Mexican-American Studies program, Nolan Cabrera, at the Center for the Study of Higher Education. He found that students who took Mexican-American studies got better overall test scores and graduated at some of the highest rates in the district. He told the Tucson School Board they shouldn't cut the program. They didn't listen.
The TUSD board voted to eliminate the program. And it was very, very heavy-handed. I mean, representatives from the district came into classes, removed what were considered objectionable materials. The people who had been teaching Mexican-American studies were told, you know, your monitors will pop into your room unannounced at any given moment.
One of the monitors sent into classes cited Acosta for calling students mija or mijo, my daughter, my son, saying it was unprofessional.
This is when you start seeing what we're talking about when we explain that education has a history of having, you know, European-American middle-class values projected onto every part of the institution as normal. Mija, mijo, that's a term of endearment, and it's a term of connection culturally.
Tom Horn, the former superintendent of schools, became the state attorney general and personally argued the case brought by Acosta and the other teachers. They had sued on the grounds the state was limiting their free speech. The case made national news. Here's a bit from The Daily Show.
The Tucson School Board had little choice but to end the Mexican-American Studies program, protecting kids from dangerous teachers like Curtis Acosta.
Our students are much more likely to graduate.
And you do that by teaching them to hate white people.
We don't teach them to hate white people.
School board member Michael Hicks.
Honestly, this law won't be applied to any other of our courses. It was strictly written for one course, which is the Mexican-American Studies program. And nobody has complained about any of the Pan-Asian or any of the other courses that are being taught.
Eventually, the court found teachers couldn't choose what they wanted to teach. Acosta joined the University of Arizona and helped create ethnic studies programs across the country that have since flourished. Things were calm until this summer, when a case brought by Tucson students and parents made it into court. They sued the state of Arizona again to reinstate Acosta's program. Acosta and a lot of other people from the first case were called again to testify.
There's been times where I felt I lost my country. Having to re-engage with all that again has been really difficult. Really difficult.
This week, U.S. Circuit Judge A. Wallace Tashima struck down the state's law targeting the Mexican-American Studies program, saying it was motivated by anti-Mexican-American attitudes and, quote, a desire to advance a political agenda by capitalizing on race-based fears. Tom Horn responded in a statement saying, quote, the proper role of the public schools is to bring together students of different backgrounds and teach them to treat each other as individuals. This decision promotes a program that does the opposite, divides students by race and promotes ethnic chauvinism, end quote. I checked in with Curtis Acosta, Nolan Cabrera, and Luis Valdez. Here's Cabrera's reaction.
I am pleasantly surprised. I'm so used to both overt and covert racial animus driving so much state policy and state rhetoric in Arizona and now in the nation as a whole.
Valdez, the Mexican-American student from a trailer park, just got his PhD in public health. He was happy about the judge's decision, but said it was bittersweet.
This law and the implications of this law did so much more damage to the community than they could have ever imagined. So it feels like so much time and effort that could have been better spent.
That was something Acosta talked about, too. How many students missed out on taking Mexican-American studies because of this state law. But in the end, he said, the whole 10-year fight was worth it. I caught him in a car.
You know, I never thought reading Judge Tashima's language is amazingly validating and affirming. And to be honest, Rupo, we wanted to win, but I never thought I would feel like my colleagues and I were validated. I just wanted those who we knew did wrong by our students and our community to be held accountable.
For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. A sheep rancher in British Columbia has to evacuate because of massive wildfires. She has to leave her sheep and her beloved sheepdogs behind.
We put out a 35-pound bag of dog food, and then we just left. There was nothing else we could do.
20 days later, she was in for a surprise. Find out what happened ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The announcement late last month took many by surprise, especially the top brass at the Pentagon. First, President Trump tweeted that transgender people would no longer be allowed in the U.S. military. Then several days later, he followed up with this statement.
I think I'm doing a lot of people a favor by coming out and just saying it. As you know, it's been a very complicated issue for the military. It's been a very confusing issue for the military. And I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
For weeks, though, there were few details on what exactly the president is ordering the military to do. Now the White House has reportedly come up with 2.5 pages of guidelines that would give the Pentagon some leeway in implementing Trump's transgender ban. Bryn Tannehill has been thinking a lot about what those guidelines will mean. She's a former U.S. Navy pilot who left the Naval Reserve in 2010 to transition to a woman. She's now advocacy director for SPARTA, an organization for LGBT service members. Bryn, Defense Secretary James Mattis will get to decide a transgender individual's deployability. What does that mean?
So we don't know exactly what that means yet. Does that mean that the Secretary of Defense is going to have to certify that each and every transgender service member is deployable at any given moment? The White House is foisting the burden of deciding what to do onto the Department of Defense with a clear bias in mind. What's more is we have transgender people serving right now in the field, in war zones, on ships. Being transgender in the long run does not affect one's ability to deploy, period.
Do we know how many transgender individuals are serving in the U.S. military?
So there's been a lot of estimates about this. Low-end estimates are 1,600 active duty to somewhere close to 6,600 active duty. High-end estimates of active duty plus Guard, National Guard, and the reserves are about 15,000 to 15,500 by the Williams Institute at UCLA.
If we can switch gears, Bryn, do you mind telling us a bit about your personal story? When did you decide you wanted to join the military, and how did your gender identity come to play in that decision?
I grew up near Luke Air Force Base, and my mom was a teacher near the base. And as a kid, I would go with her to school early in the mornings and watch the F-15s doing training and doing touch and goes. And it was just amazing. And from that moment on, I knew I wanted to be a pilot, nothing else. And I pursued that dream relentlessly through college and high school and then through flight school. And eventually I did. I ended up being a naval aviator. But at the same time, as I figured out what my gender identity was from 13 on or so, I knew that was something I would have to hide. And even as the days of Don't Ask, Don't Tell wound down, transgender people were not going to be affected by the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that's why, in order to transition, I had to leave the reserves and give up my career. And that's been one of the hardest things I ever had to do.
You were at the Naval Academy, and you've described a moment when you had to make a decision about whether to sign on for 5 more years. Can you take us back to that moment and what was going through your mind?
It was in late August day, much like one today. And I stood there thinking, I have to commit to another 2 years at the Naval Academy and another 5 years of active duty service, but I know I'm trans. And which one is more important to me? And I chose serving my country and being a naval aviator because being trans is hard and because I had worked so long and so hard to achieve this dream. But it also meant subsuming myself in ways that were not healthy, that eventually when they did start coming out after I was married, after I had kids, after I had a career, it was tearing me apart. It was tearing my family apart, that I was unable to talk to anyone or get help or to work through this or get medical care. Putting our service members who are trans, who will continue to be trans, because long after this policy either comes or goes or happens or doesn't happen, there will be transgender people in the military. We have to make a choice whether we are going to put them in a position where they have to hide themselves.
When you were in uniform, did you spend a lot of time acting, sort of pretending to be someone you weren't?
I remember standing in front of a mirror in a suit and a tie and looking at it and thinking, okay, who am I today? What's my motivations? How do I express myself? How do I present myself as someone I am categorically not? Imagine method acting your way through life, through a gender that really doesn't fit you, that you have to try and fit yourself into and constantly be on guard not to step outside those boundaries. That takes a toll over time.
What would it take for transgender individuals to feel not just tolerated in the armed forces, but truly accepted?
most of our service members who have come out, who have started transitioning, have had absolutely fantastic support from their chains of command. We have had Secretary of Defense Mattis push back in Congress against attempts to ban transgender service members. It's not a matter of being accepted. It's not a matter of the DOD not wanting this. The DOD has basically embraced this policy, and now there is an attempt to repeal the current policy for transgender service members for no other reason than politics and discrimination against a marginalized group of people who simply want to do their jobs, serve their countries, take care of their families.
Bryn Tannehill is the advocacy director for SPARTA, an organization for LGBT service members. She's a former U.S. Navy pilot who left the Naval Reserve in 2010 to transition to a woman. Thanks so much, Bryn.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
This week, a new word started trending among Twitter users in Spain, Andalus, as in Al-Andalus, the old Arabic name for Spain, back when it was ruled by Muslims centuries ago. And it's been trending because ISIS has used the term in its propaganda following the deadly attack last week in Barcelona, first in claiming responsibility for the carnage, then in this slick video, which mixes excerpts from news reports, music, and statements from ISIS fighters in Arabic and, for the first time, in Spanish.
Tonight, a trail of terror in the heart of Barcelona.
Y con el permiso de Allah, el Andalus volverá a ser lo que fue, tierra de califato.
The Spanish speaker in combat fatigues is saying, with God's permission, Al-Andalus will once again be the land of the caliphate. Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times is something of an expert on ISIS propaganda. She's currently in northern Iraq. Rukmini, is this a new thing for ISIS to be talking about Al-Andalus?
It's not a new thing. As you mentioned, this is a term that is centuries old. It's the old Arabic name for the Iberian Peninsula, so it's basically Greater Spain, including Portugal. And if you'll recall, the Islamic State is aiming to create a caliphate, which is an Islamic empire that they believe will reach across the world. And they're trying to recreate a golden age of Islam. So they often hearken back to the old words that were used by early Muslims for these territories. And Al-Andalus is what Spain was referred to as.
And what we now know is the Spanish city of Córdoba has special meaning. During the period when it was Al-Andalus and ruled by Muslims, it was a beacon of learning, culture, and art. During what was known as the Dark Ages in the rest of Europe, how significant is Andalus to the jihadi narrative?
It's not particularly significant. If you'll recall other terms that we have learned from ISIS, for example, the name Dabiq, this is the name of a small town in northern Syria, that holds an outsized influence because Dabiq appears in their end of times prophecies and scriptures that basically describe the end of the world. And they believe that it is in Dabiq that the final battle between Muslims and the rest of the world will be waged. But it goes to this idea that they are bringing back an old Islamic era, a golden age, and that they are going to restore the dignity of Muslims. I mean, this is, of course, through their eyes.
Now, Catholic Spain, you know, ruthlessly persecuted and expelled Muslims and Jews, of course. But for ISIS, is that persecution of Muslims, is that something they play up?
They play up the persecution of Muslims all over. And so, for example, in the past year, I've seen them put out propaganda about the Central African Republic, where for several years now, a vicious conflict between Christian militias and a Muslim rebel group have been ongoing. I have covered that conflict back when I was in West Africa, and I happen to know that the atrocities are on both sides. Christians have killed Muslims, Muslims have killed Christians. But in the ISIS retelling of that conflict, it's only one side. It's the Christians who are subjugating and hurting and harming Muslims, and they play that up so that they can have a narrative of victimhood which draws people to their cause.
For all the talk, Spain has not been the target of an ISIS attack until last week. What do you think accounts for that?
Actually, Spain has been the target of numerous foiled plots. That's the case in many of the countries that are seeing their first attacks now. That was the case in the United Kingdom, which had its first attack in March, but where a dozen or more plots have been disrupted in recent years. You have to understand that ISIS is actively trying to hit all of the areas in the West that they consider their enemy, and they have recruits from many of these areas. Spain is one of those places, and there have been disruptive plots there. It's just that now is the first successful one, fortunately.
ISIS is losing ground, as you know, in Iraq and Syria. Is this an attempt to shift the narrative?
I don't think so. I've reported on this a lot. I feel that it's part of our own propaganda to constantly talk about how ISIS is losing territory and therefore is lashing out in the West. If you look back at the timeline of when ISIS fighters began returning to Europe, they started returning to France in particular in January of 2014, which is months and months before ISIS even declared a caliphate, and about 9 months before the first airstrikes began against the group in Iraq and Syria. This is a group that has, since its inception, labeled Western countries as their enemy and has tried to carry out attacks. Again, what has happened is that they were not successful until recently. And so now we are seeing the fruition of those efforts rather than the first attempt.
Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times speaking to us from northern Iraq. Thanks, Rukmini.
My pleasure.
Right after that vehicle attack in Barcelona last week, Spanish and Catalan authorities were united in condemning it. That was significant because the national government in Madrid and the regional government in Catalonia are otherwise at odds over plans for a Catalan independence referendum this fall. All that was put aside last week, but now the unity has been replaced by finger-pointing over which police force missed information about the terrorist plot. My BBC colleague Tom Burridge reports from Catalonia.
Police vans now guard the top of Las Ramblas here, where Yunis Abu Yaqub drove a rented van onto the pavement, killing as many as he could. The officers, alongside with automatic machine guns, are from Catalonia's own police force called Mossos. It deals with counter-terrorism work in this region, and it is separate from Spain's Civil Guard and the Spanish National Police.
Hoy por hoy, hora 12.
In the wake of last week's attacks on Spanish and Catalan radio and in the newspapers,
el conseller catalán de Interior defiende a los Mossos de Escuadra,
debate and recriminations.
Una persona radical o que podía,
the fractious relationship between Spanish ministers in Madrid and the autonomous government here in Catalonia, all too evident, amid questions. Was information about the terror cell known and shared? Was an opportunity to stop them missed?
The security services have to show to everyone, to all citizens here and in Europe, that they can protect us.
That's Maite Carrasco, a Spanish journalist who specializes in security and terrorism.
So for Spain, it's a pity that we are fighting like in the 20th century, completely blind, not seeing that we have a global threat. And we have to be aware that we have to be united and not to show this image of lack of coordination and division, because the terrorists want this exactly.
All of the terror cell behind the Barcelona attacks came from the town of Ripoll in the foothills of the Pyrenees. At least 8 young men, all of North African origin, and the imam, Abdelbaki Assati, the apparent ringleader behind a wider plot. Most of the attackers came to play football just opposite Yunis Abu Yaqub's house. And a neighbour who's just come out of the family house, almost in tears, told us what everyone is saying here, that these were shy young men. They weren't rebels. They weren't into drugs. There was, they say, no clue that they were radicalised and motivated to cause mass murder.
Yo lo conozco desde pequeño, te digo, íbamos juntos a ese colegio.
José told us he's known Driss Ukabir, who is currently in prison and could face terrorism charges, since they were young. Driss's brother Musa Ukabir was one of those who tried to go on a killing spree with 4 others in the coastal resort of Cambrils. He was shot dead by police. All of those who ended up as terrorists spent their afternoons here, says José. They never talked like extremists, he tells us.
No, nunca.
It has emerged that the apparent ringleader, Abdelbaki Assati, was known to the authorities in Belgium. Assati spent time there. And last year, a Belgian police officer warned a colleague here in Barcelona, apparently in an informal conversation, about the imam. Spanish and Catalan anonymous sources have both been briefing journalists about each other's perceived failings.
If you talk to police officers on the street,
they get on well.
Pero cuando se trata de
But when it's about coordinating at a higher level, they all want to be in charge.
Al final todos quieren liderar.
Ana Puncí is a journalist at Radio Barcelona and specializes in policing.
A nivel operativo no está funcionando.
At the operational level, it's not working. Each side often finds it difficult to get information from the other.
Pero de un lado y del otro.
It is probably down to politics.
Política, pues probablemente.
Because relations between politicians are poor. And these filters down to the police.
Trasladando más abajo.
In 1 month, Catalonia's autonomous government plans to hold what Spain says is an illegal referendum on independence. The political climate will probably get worse. The question is, what will that mean for security and policing?
The BBC's Tom Burridge reporting from Catalonia. As we speak, Hurricane Harvey is barreling toward the Gulf Coast, and it could be a big one. Harvey has the potential to be the strongest storm to hit the U.S. mainland in a dozen years. We're talking winds well above 100 miles an hour and more than 30 inches of rain over parts of Texas before it's all over. These days, scientists have gotten pretty good at estimating the impact climate change has on certain big weather events, like heat waves, droughts, and heavy rains. But if you're wondering specifically if Hurricane Harvey is caused by climate change, you may have to wait a while for an answer. Gabriel Vecchi is a professor of geosciences at Princeton University and an expert in the emerging field of climate attribution. Gabriel, how exactly does climate attribution work? I mean, how do you determine if a specific weather event is linked to climate change?
There's a first step. Look at the observational record of events like the one that we see and estimate how the probability has changed. Has a particular event gone from being, say, a 1-in-100-year event to a 1-in-20-year event? The following step is to connect whatever change in probability that we see to climate change, and we do that using climate models. And we can then compare the odds of these types of events and pinpoint the causality to climate change.
So what are you then able to actually say about a weather event?
We can make statements such as an event that previously had, for example, a 1-in-100-year chance of happening, now, because of global warming, has a 1-in-40-year return period. And this example that I'm using is actually taken from an analysis looking at the August 2016 intense rainfall events over Louisiana, where we were able to assess that the odds of those types of rain events have doubled over the 20th century. Now, there are events that are easier to connect to climate change and others for which we're facing steeper challenges.
And I understand that one of those is hurricanes. I mean, that you can't apply that same modeling and looking back at the record to conclude anything. Why are hurricanes more difficult to determine the cause of?
So the way we see hurricanes today, where we have a vast array of satellites, we have aircraft reconnaissance missions, we have a number of different sensors, is very different from the way we saw hurricanes 100 years ago. 100 years ago, if a hurricane is going to be seen at sea, it would have to come across the path of some unfortunate ship, and that ship would have to record its existence.
So you're noticing more hurricanes now, but you don't know whether there's actually more, you're just able to record more.
Exactly. So we're seeing more storms, we're seeing more intense storms, but we don't know if that is by virtue of the storms being more frequent and more intense, or by virtue of the fact that we're just better at finding them. So because we expect global warming to make hurricanes and tropical cyclones more intense over the coming century, this creates a little bit of a frustration for me and a little bit of a puzzle for the community as to how to deal with the fact that our past records don't allow us to test that prediction.
How long will it be before scientists can look at individual hurricanes and say, yes or no, this was caused or made more powerful by climate change?
It is not going to be much more than a decade or so before we can actually have some relatively confident statements about individual hurricanes and climate change.
Gabriel Vecchi is an expert on the connection between hurricanes and climate change at Princeton University. The people of British Columbia have been having the opposite problem this summer. It's very dry and massive forest fires have been ravaging the region. Thousands of people have had to flee their homes, among them Lynn Landry and her husband. One day last month, they watched as the fires approached their sheep ranch near the small town of 100 Mile House.
It got worse as the day went on, and they had bombers on it and all sorts of helicopters and that. And then when it got dark, they stopped. And then the whole ridge from our place just went up in flames. It was unbelievable. And we had neighbors, you know, and we all got together and everybody phoned each other and we evacuated.
Landry grabbed her four border collies, but she had to leave behind many other animals, a handful of cattle, her cat, her flock of 90 sheep, and her two huge white sheepdogs, Tad and Sophie.
We put out a 35-pound bag of dog food, and then we just left. There was nothing else we could do.
You were away for many days. What did you think you'd find in terms of the sheep and the dogs? Did you think they'd make it through this?
We knew the dogs would either be dead or with the sheep. You know, the dogs would not have deserted the sheep. So we knew that. We were 100% confident that in spite of whatever was happening around here and the number of people and activity and that, that the dogs would stay with the sheep. The only chance the sheep had was to leave the dogs here.
So 20 days later, you're able to finally go back home. And what did you find when you got there?
So when we got back, you know, the helicopters had been over. There'd been firefighters, Forest Service. There'd been so much activity and fires that we didn't know. We got in, we came in and the dogs were there and there was about 45, 50 sheep and we knew we were missing some. So Lauren, my husband went into town and got one of our border collies and came out and then he went out in the bush with the dogs and all the rest of the sheep came in.
Aww.
So they were all right there. So we counted them and we had 88. So we missed one. We've lost one sheep, but she was an old ewe and, you know, we don't know if she wandered off or the smoke or just the stress, you know, got her.
So the dogs had hung in with those sheep and they did their job through all the
yep.
fire and mayhem. They just
yep.
stayed right there.
They stayed right there.
And when they saw you, what did they do?
When they saw us, one of them came up. Sophie wouldn't leave the sheep. Tad came up and, you know, he was kind of nervous, hesitant. And we petted him and told him everything was okay. And at this time, there were still helicopters and that flying over, you know, getting water from the lake, dousing some spot fires and stuff. And then we went down to Sophie because she was laying down where the sheep were. And we just went down and, you know, gave her a good pet.
And so how have the dogs been since the fire?
Good. Yeah, really good. Yes. We gave them steak and, you know, they've had all sorts of treats. And Tad, he's the young one. He's only six. He's, you know, he, at night when the sheep come in, we go down to feed them and that. And he's really clingy. So we spend extra time with him than we would have before. We just sit there and just pet him and, you know, he's fine.
Oh, so now Sophie and Tad are international heroes. Has it gone to their head?
No. Tad would if he knew about it, but no.
Lynn Landry, who owns a sheep ranch in 100 Mile House, British Columbia. It's a small town where fires ravaged, and her amazing dogs saved the sheep. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, those are such good dogs. And that's our show for today. The World's Theme Music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Hope you have a good weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.